The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. State-of-the-art clinical lab and imaging treatments of rheumatoid arthritis is presented by Dr. Aaron Heath.
So we're going to review some of the state-of-the-art clinical laboratory and imaging modalities that we use to monitor disease activity in rheumatoid arthritis. So in terms of how we treat RA, there have been significant changes even in the past decade. We're implementing treat-to-target strategies, and we're seeing improved outcomes. And really, we're striving to utilize more precise measurements to track disease activity in hopes of achieving our best possible outcomes for our patients. Like any disease process, establishing a diagnosis early is critical, and establishing a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis is really key. We know that rheumatoid arthritis is a persistent and progressive disease that, if untreated, can lead to disability, joint deformity, poor quality of life, and shortened life expectancy. So our goal is, in the earliest stages, to try to stratify our patients the best we can into, you know, categories. Putting patients in a category of a mild, moderate, or severe disease process, and doing our best to predict which patients are going to follow a more aggressive or progressive disease course versus those that may have a more indolent disease course. So we treat rheumatoid arthritis early and vigorously, and we've defined new targets for therapy, which we'll review shortly. And we really we're trying to use our best treatment up front to maintain low or no disease activity. And certainly with exception, we try our best to have zero tolerance for synovitis. And to do this, we institute tight disease control with the most effective combination of therapeutic agents to prevent some of the hallmarks of longstanding rheumatoid arthritis. So this diagram here, we're looking at a plain film x-ray, and you can see sort of the transition here from early to late stage RA with a severe erosion. And we know that here, shown in orange, inflammation tends to peak early in the disease, and then over time may plateau or decline, particularly with disease-modifying antirheumatic drugs or biologic agents. However, disability and inflammation can continue to increase linearly. So what we're trying to do is attack the disease early, treat as early as possible in hopes of preventing some of these long-term changes. There appears to be an optimal window of opportunity for treating RA. We know that radiographic progression occurs early and continues through the lifetime of a patient, but erosions can be detected even within 4 months of symptom onset by MRI. And 70% of patients will have some radiographic damage within the first 3 years. Additionally, the rate of progression appears to be significantly more rapid in the first year after symptom onset than in subsequent years. So this therapeutic window of opportunity during the first year seems to offer us the greatest opportunity for achieving optimal short and long-term outcomes. So we're aggressively treating and instituting tight disease control using frequent monitoring and goal-oriented changes in therapy. So briefly to discuss our treat-to-target strategy, you know, like any decision in medicine, it's based on a mutual decision between patient and physician, the primary goal being to maximize long-term health-related quality of life and preventing structural damage, normalizing function and social participation. And really key to this is eradicating inflammation. And measuring disease activity and adjusting therapy based on these measures and treating to a target optimizes these outcomes. So our primary target is a state of clinical remission, which we'll define shortly. You know, there certainly are patients where low disease activity may be an alternative, particularly in long-standing disease or if patients have significant comorbid conditions that may make it difficult to use very aggressive immunosuppressive therapy. Until our target's reached, we should be adjusting therapy at least every 3 to 6 months and measuring disease activity and documenting it regularly, as frequently as monthly, in patients with high disease activity measures. And once our target is achieved, we want to do our best to maintain that throughout the course of the disease. So in terms of how we assess disease activity in rheumatoid arthritis and how we determine if we have tight disease control, primarily we're using clinical, laboratory, and imaging measures. So clinical, you know, that's our physical exam. And we use a number of disease activity measures that, you know, include our physical exam finding. And in rheumatology, a good physical exam really is, you know, very important. We want to make sure we're carefully palpating joints. You know, rheumatoid, as we know, tends to be a symmetric arthritis involving the small joints of the hands. But early in disease can be asymmetric and shouldn't preclude the diagnosis of RA. We want to make sure that we're appreciating and distinguishing synovitis, which is often doughy or spongy, from the firm knobby enlargement in osteoarthritis, as seen on the left of the screen. Pain with passive range of motion, for example, flexion or extension of a wrist that elicits pain may indicate subtle inflammation, as does squeezing along the MCP or MTP joints. So in terms of disease activity measures, in 2012, the American College of Rheumatology put together recommendations for validated disease measures. And they started off with about 63 currently available measures to follow disease activity and narrowed it down to these six. And we'll review them briefly. The six can be broken down into patient-reported outcomes, composite physician and patient assessment, and composite measures that also include some lab value, namely an acute phase reactant. We often additionally use certain measures, including the HAQ, or Health Assessment Questionnaire, which measures functional measures and limitations in day-to-day life, and a short form 36, which also is a measure of quality of life. These are purely patient-reported and have limitations, but you know, as we know, a patient's perspective and how they perceive their disease is also quite critical in our overall assessment of their well-being. The use of some of these measures varies among rheumatologists. I don't know that there's one that is preferred. It often comes down to experience, how easy it is to complete, and also the need for laboratory monitoring. So we'll review these briefly. So the purely patient-reported assessments, this is your patient activity scale, the PAS2 and RAPID3. And I know these are small, but just so you can get an idea, these are essentially forms that patients are completing prior to seeing us. And it's essentially asking questions about how easy it is to complete day-to-day activities. They rate their pain from 0 to 10 and how their rheumatoid arthritis is affecting their overall well-being on a scale from 0 to 10. A RAPID3, similarly, quite easy to fill out, and it's nice to have this when you're seeing the patient. We then have composite physician and patient measures. The clinical disease activity index is a 28 tender and swollen joint count with a patient and physician global assessment. And this is what the form looks like, and also fairly easy to complete. You're doing, this includes physical exam, a patient physician assessment, and from here you very quickly can get a score and put patients in a state, you know, we can categorize them as meeting criteria for remission, low, moderate, or high disease activity. A DAS-28 is also quite frequently used. This is also a 28 tender and swollen joint count, patient global assessment. This adds a laboratory measure, sedimentation rate or a C-reactive protein. And there's a calculator for this that is easy to access. The calculator is required because it's somewhat of a complex formula. Just to mention, there is another score that's quite similar, the DAS, disease activity score. Really, the only difference here is you have a 44 joint count, and I don't use this often, but you know, I do follow quite a few patients that have, you know, severe rheumatoid arthritis with a predilection for MTP joints. And if you look at the joints that the DAS-28 includes, you know, the feet are not included. So I like to follow a DAS in these patients. But, you know, it's a slightly more time-consuming to, to come up with a number. This is an example of the DAS-28. You know, we have a tender and swollen joint count, a measure of an acute phase reactant, and a patient global health score. And from here, you get a number, and greater than 5.1 would be considered high disease activity and less than 2.6 remission. So another composite measure that includes labs, the SDI, or Simple Disease Activity Index. This is similar to the CDI that we mentioned, but includes a C-reactive protein. So moving on to laboratory measures, we have a number of serum biomarkers in rheumatology that we use quite frequently. Rheumatoid factor and CCP antibody status. These are tests that are certainly play a role in diagnosing disease and part of the criteria for the diagnosis of RA. They also are prognostic indicators in that they predict more severe or erosive disease, particularly when both are positive and high titers, but they're not tests that are routinely followed as measures of disease activity. You know, when you get these tests, you get a quantitative number, but the fact that it's going up or down doesn't reflect disease activity. Similarly, a newer test, a 14-33N protein, like RF and CCP, may play a role in diagnosing and as a prognostic indicator for more erosive disease. Interestingly, it also is seen in erosive psoriatic arthritis, but really no role in monitoring disease activity. We mentioned acute phase reactants, sedimentation rate, and C-reactive protein. There's varying opinions as to which may be best in monitoring inflammatory arthritis. I don't know that there's one that's preferred over another. There are subtle differences between the two. A C-reactive protein will rise and fall more quickly, whereas a sed rate can stay elevated for weeks. And there are many factors that can, you know, increase either falsely elevate both. You know, we know that infection and cancer and chronic liver and kidney disease can elevate these acute phase reactants, as well as age. A sedimentation rate is often expected to increase with age, and we correct for that. Another newer blood test, referred to as a multiple biomarker of disease activity, commercially this test is the Vectra DA. This is a measure of 12 serum biomarkers that I listed here, and you know, from this blood test, an algorithm generates a score from 1 to 100, and based on the number that you get, this can put a patient in a low, moderate, or high disease activity state. And you know, there's studies that do show that this is a good marker for disease activity, may predict erosive disease, as well as risk of flare after stopping remittive therapy. It correlates well with a number of disease activity measures that we mentioned, so may be an important marker of disease activity in conjunction with our exam and some of these other measures. You know, like any test, there are limitations, and you know, the question becomes when you get a discordant result. You know, a patient who clinically appears to be doing well with relative lack of synovitis and maybe normal acute phase reactants, but this test comes back high. You know, is that someone you're going to add a second disease-modifying drug or change biologics? You know, that's still somewhat debatable. And there's also a cost involved with this test. So not perfect, but there is ongoing research identifying some of its strengths and weaknesses. So finally, we'll review some of the imaging measures that we use to assess disease activity. So, you know, we use imaging not only for diagnosing, but also to assess disease severity and activity, predict rate of progression, monitor disease progression, and monitoring response to therapy. So primarily we're using X-ray, MRI, and ultrasound. CAT scan is used sparingly. This table illustrates comparing some of these modalities. And you know, the point here is, you know, I just want you to see that, you know, ultrasound and MRI are superior not only for diagnostic purposes, particularly early in disease, but also for detecting inflammation, synovitis, and tenosynovitis. We still do generally like to get X-rays, particularly at baseline. It's nice to have a set of hand and wrist films, and they certainly are useful in diagnosing. But they're particularly if erosions are present, as seen on the left of the screen, or periarticular osteopenia. But these findings primarily are later stage findings. So there's a reason why they're not included in the updated diagnostic criteria for rheumatoid arthritis, because we're hoping to prevent some of these things from happening. And there's really not a whole lot of value for detecting synovitis or subtle soft tissue inflammation with X-ray. We do have scoring systems for X-ray. There are a few. This is the SHARP score, and primarily used in clinical trials. As you can see, it's quite involved and really not practical for day-to-day use, but it's a scoring system where we can track disease progression on X-ray. MRI and ultrasound are powerful tools for detecting not only erosions, but also effusion, synovitis, and tenosynovitis, and they're highly sensitive for detecting some of the earlier inflammatory changes, even when X-rays may be normal. MRI is particularly sensitive to changes in inflammatory activity over time, so certainly plays a role in the future rate or predicting radiographic progression. So this slide is to illustrate the disconnect that we can see between plain films and MRI. As you can see in this X-ray of the wrist, if you look closely, there may be some focal lucencies in the carpal bones of the radial head. When you do an MRI, there are obvious erosions in the carpal bones, and they enhance they contain enhancing synovium. So these are active, this is active synovitis, and there's active erosions here. Another example here, looking at an MCP joint, you can look, comparing it to the other MCP joints, it certainly doesn't appear normal, but the joint space appears pretty well preserved, and probably there is an erosion here. When you do an MRI, you can see there's severe damage here and just a huge erosion at the MCP head that's missed for the most part with X-ray. MRI can also be used to track disease activity. On the right side of the screen, we have an MRI at baseline. The green arrows are depicting synovitis and the yellow tenosynovitis. And then after 6 months on a TNF antagonist, you can certainly see some improvement. And finally, ultrasound. This is a promising tool in the assessment of joint damage and disease activity. The sensitivity of power Doppler ultrasound to detect synovitis is comparable to MRI, so certainly may be a more cost-effective way of monitoring disease activity than getting MRIs every year. And the American College of Rheumatology has issued recommendations for the reasonable use of ultrasound in monitoring disease activity in a number of inflammatory arthritides. There are studies that suggest that power Doppler ultrasound actually has a greater sensitivity for detecting synovitis than our physical exam. So certainly we still view ultrasound as a complementary procedure and not an alternative to exam, namely because the significance of subclinical synovitis or synovitis that's detected on ultrasound but not clinically is somewhat debated. There are some studies that suggest that in patients who've achieved remission, detecting subclinical synovitis may put them at a very high risk for relapse, whereas small trials looking at treating patients towards a goal of clinical remission versus ultrasound remission, namely no synovitis on ultrasound, there's not a huge clinical benefit one way or the other. But we're diagnosing rheumatoid arthritis in its earliest stages. The term preclinical RA is something that's somewhat new. This would be a patient who maybe comes in with some joint pain, has a strong family history of rheumatoid arthritis, and an RF and a CCP were checked, and they're both very high. So certainly this patient may not meet criteria for rheumatoid arthritis at this time, but they likely will develop it. And detecting ultrasound in these patients, detecting synovitis subclinically may serve as a prognostic indicator. Limitations with ultrasound: mostly we have small studies. There's no clear standard yet for the type of joint that needs to be examined or the number of joints that should be monitored. And as mentioned, there's some disagreement as to the relevance of synovitis, particularly if it's subclinical. It's also highly operator dependent, some variability among how it's interpreted and how synovitis is graded, and there's variability among the quality of ultrasound equipment as well. There are protocols that have been developed to monitor disease activity as well as assess for remission, and they vary by which joints are examined and how synovitis is detected. But power Doppler ultrasound seems to correlate most with the most of our disease activity measures, as well as our clinical exam, acute phase reactants, and MRI. So synovitis with ultrasound could be detected with either grayscale, which you're imaging essentially anatomical structures and assessing for erosions, hypertrophy, and effusion, and power Doppler, which can detect microvascular blood flow as seen with active synovitis. And you know, this is essentially a busy slide, but to show how synovitis is graded. You know, it's graded 0 to 3, with 3 being severe. With the grayscale, severe synovial hypertrophy as a hypoechoic area will be visualized as well as with effusion. And with the power Doppler, severe synovitis would be greater than 50% of the total background lights up with the Doppler. So just a couple examples here. We have an MCP joint in the longitudinal view. On the right side of the screen, you can see, you know, labeled a marked erosion. You know, that's clear. You know, looking at this joint on ultrasound, this would be something that would be hard to miss clinically. You know, this would be a very a swollen and likely tender joint. But with the grayscale, you can see this area of marked hypoechoic synovial hypertrophy. And with the power Doppler on, you know, greater than 50% of this background lights up. So this is severe synovitis. However, when we use ultrasound, things aren't always this clear. And you know, here's an example of something that's a little more subtle. On the top here, we have clinically a tender, mildly swollen joint. With the grayscale, you know, there is some synovial hypertrophy and probable effusion. And when you turn on the power Doppler, you know, it lights up. There is trace power Doppler hyperactivity there. So that there's some ultrasound synovitis noted here. In the middle, we have a non-tender, non-swollen joint. So this is to illustrate more of a normal-appearing joint on ultrasound. There's really no significant grayscale synovitis or power Doppler activity. And then another joint here, this was a non-tender, mildly swollen joint in examination. There is some synovial hypertrophy and power Doppler signal present. So one more example. You know, you're looking at, on the right side of the screen, a clinically swollen and tender MCP joint. They're using color Doppler here, but you can see, you know, there's a lot of signal here. This is severe synovitis. On the other side of the screen, we have a non-tender, non-swollen joint, clinically, but there is some synovitis that's detected with ultrasound. So ultrasound, you know, as I mentioned, also certainly plays a role in diagnosis. Here we have an MCP joint on the top in the longitudinal plane, and there's a significant erosion present that can be visualized in the transverse plane. And like MRI, it can be used to track disease. You know, and at the top, we're looking at a baseline ultrasound. There's significant hypoechogenic thickening. You know, this is high-grade grayscale synovitis. And after we place patients on a biologic agent, this is improved. So in the hands of an experienced operator, ultrasound certainly can be an effective tool in monitoring disease activity and assessing for synovitis. Also, I find it useful in distinguishing inflammatory from non-inflammatory arthritides, you know, when a diagnosis is in question. We have patients, you know, we always have patients with rheumatoid arthritis and coexisting osteoarthritis or fibromyalgia. So, you know, I often use ultrasound in these patients, particularly if their rheumatoid clinically appears well controlled, their labs look good. You know, we can essentially confirm that if they're having joint pain and there's no synovitis on ultrasound, probably their pain is related to something else. It's also a live test. You can easily examine multiple joints. And I find that when I do ultrasound in the clinic, when patients are able to visualize their joints and see inflammation on the screen, and you're kind of walking them through what they see, it increases their understanding of their underlying disease process and enables them to participate more fully in their care. So in terms of assessment of disease activity, currently we rely on composite patient and physician measures and our physical exam primarily. And to this, generally we're adding some laboratory measure, be it an acute phase reactant or this multiple biomarker of drug disease activity, the Vectra DA. And then imaging also certainly plays a role here. Like I said, it's nice to have x-rays at baseline, but musculoskeletal ultrasound is becoming more widely utilized to monitor disease activity. there's always a continued need for more reliable biomarkers, not only to predict the onset of disease, but also make the diagnosis at its earliest stages and predict those patients who are at higher risk, highest risk for rapidly progressive disease. And also, there's a huge need for some way of determining who's going to respond to what medicine. You know, if we had a test that could predict a methotrexate responder versus a non-responder, or we could determine if a patient's RA was driven by TNF-alpha or IL-6, you know, that would make it much easier to target therapy. And there are ongoing trials looking into this. So currently, in our assessment of disease activity, a treat-to-target approach leads to better outcomes. It's important to define this target up front. And collecting data to assess and monitor activity is really essential to this, and moving forward likely will be something that we're obligated to track when we're looking at our outcome measures for our patients.